This is CSAP Science and Policy Podcast, where we're bringing you the latest evidence and expertise to improve public policymaking. This week, we're proud to present the 16th episode in our series on science, policy, and pandemics. This episode is brought to you in partnership with Cambridge Infectious Diseases and the Cambridge Immunology Network. In this episode, our host, Dr. Rob Doubleday, is joined by experts to explore the impact of COVID-19 on cities.
I think one of the things that we've discovered through COVID is that it has exposed the existing vulnerabilities of the urban poor. What we've discovered to our horror is that cities cannot survive without migrants, but we're inherently hostile towards migrants and treat them very poorly. So we've seen the economic toll that the lockdown has had on them. What we've also discovered is that the appalling conditions in which they are forced to live in have also rendered them the most vulnerable, where particularly in slums where the urban poor reside, they tend to live in very close proximity to each other. Physical space is at a premium. A lot of them are dependent on fetching water from community standposts and also have to rely on public or community toilets. We know for a fact that there are many urban settlements in India, cities in India, where slums where the urban poor reside have become hotspots. And in fact, they've managed to track down that community toilets or public toilets were actually the reason or the source of the infection. So we've got to learn from all of this and completely reimagine housing and water sanitation services for the urban poor in our cities moving ahead. I think one of the lessons that we should learn from this, if we want to prevent outbreaks of this kind to occur again in any of our large cities in India, we'll have to completely relook at how we plan housing settlements for the urban poor. We need to look at how we're planning for provision of water and sanitation services for the urban poor, where you should ideally be looking at services within the household rather than compelling them to have to use public facilities for both fetching water and for sanitation. And I think all of this will require investment. All of this will require political will. I think one of the tragedies is that while COVID has made it very clear that hand hygiene is important, we're not seeing an equal attention to improve or invest in access to safe, assured water and sanitation services at a household level. And you will actually need to do both of these in the long run if you want to prevent epidemics of this kind from occurring again.
Welcome, everybody, to the Center for Science and Policy podcast. This is our 16th episode on science policy issues raised by the pandemic. And in this episode, we're going to talk about cities. Cities, obviously, is a site for the transmission of this infectious disease. Cities as places where people live. We're interested in how public health understandings of cities and broader understandings of cities and how people live in cities are being highlighted and changed by our current experience of the COVID pandemic. You've just heard from VK Madhavan, Chief Executive of WaterAid India. Throughout the rest of today's episode, we're joined by Tolu Oni, who is a Clinical Senior Research Fellow at the Medical Research Council's Epidemiology Unit at Cambridge. She's a public health physician and an urban epidemiologist. And Ash Amin, who is a professor of geography, also at the University of Cambridge. Ash is an urban, cultural and economic geographer whose work has included over the years a particular interest in urban life. Welcome both. I'd like to begin, Tolu, if I may, by asking you particularly about how cities in Africa, I know you have looked at cities in Africa, how cities you know have coped with the COVID-19 pandemic.
Thanks, Robert. I think in thinking about the response, it's important to understand what we're talking about. Fundamentally, with the response, we're aiming to reduce exposure, we're aiming to reduce transmission and ultimately vulnerability that impacts on both. From a public health perspective, firstly, we're thinking about primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention. So primary prevention is I'm well, how do I stay well? Secondary prevention is you have cases, how do you reduce the risk of onward transmission? And tertiary is you have some onward transmission, so sort of local outbreaks, how do you mitigate those? Underlying all of those really is breaking transmission cycles. If we take the example of, so two cities that I'm working in the moment, Cape Town in South Africa and Lagos in Nigeria, broadly, when we talk about reducing exposure, we've seen the similar blunt instrument that has been applied in different cities and countries of lockdown, as it were, quote unquote, or shelter in place, movement restrictions, fundamentally to break that transmission cycle. We've seen pushing for hand hygiene and physical distancing to prevent the pandemic prevention. One of the interesting things in these, so say in Cape Town, for example, if you talk about pandemic prevention, it's great to say hand hygiene, it's great to say physical distancing, but one is quickly confronted with the realities for a significant portion of people. How does this go from being a theoretical advice to something that can be practiced, particularly amongst the most vulnerable? How does access to water and sanitation impact your ability to follow that advice? How does where you live impact on your ability to actually maintain physical distancing?
So take the example of Cape Town. You know, what measures have been taken by authorities to lock down or enforce social distancing? I mean, that's obviously a thing that impacts on people's lives very directly. How's that worked in Cape Town?
Well, we actually saw, I mean, obviously this is a national level measures put in place. South Africa had one of the strictest lockdowns globally, but in the most severe form, it was completely stay at home, no physical activity outside, no alcohol being sold, no smoking, no cigarettes being sold. Like, it was complete lockdown. And quickly you realize that you have to ensure that people have water to be able to break cycles. You have to ensure people have food. So food and water were the things. So we saw, for example, at the provincial level in Cape Town, the government taking extraordinary measures to actually bus in water into spaces where access to water was not sufficiently reliable. So you saw these extraordinary measures to ensure access to water. In Lagos, for example, food, we saw efforts to decentralize access to markets so that people would normally, where you'd normally have to go a long distance to access markets to sell fresh fruits and vegetables. We saw, and this was less the government actually, but more community and professional organizations, associations, decentralizing the markets and bringing the markets to communities so you don't have to go far to access food. And really an activation of civil society to ensure food access. At a mega city level, and Ash will probably speak more to this, it really is much more all hands on deck, right? So you saw much more multiplicity of approaches to get to the most vulnerable. We actually saw Lagos as a city push for those lockdown restrictions before the national effort. So I think there was a kind of a strong city component to the initial response to the lockdown. But I think fundamentally, the challenge that one is quickly confronted with is what the pandemic has exposed. So the challenge you're quickly confronted with is not necessarily the response. Is not necessarily limitations in the ability to respond, but really just the fact that the pandemic has amplified these inequities. So you see, it's not just a matter of everything was fine and now we have to provide food, but, you know, we needed to provide food anyway, and now the most vulnerable are even more vulnerable. So it becomes a catch-up game that is quite challenging. And the key issue really is thinking about how do we rethink how we think about emergency and how we think about responding. Because we know a lot of these vulnerabilities and severities are preventable. And I think that's one thing that we haven't sufficiently internalized when we talk about emergency response. We talk about, okay, we've got this calamity, let's respond to it. But actually, even in the context of an outbreak, a disaster is preventable if you have addressed some of those fundamental underlying factors that influence vulnerability.
Again, let's continue with Lagos as an example. What would be an example, a more specific example of the kinds of underlying vulnerabilities that could and should be invested in or worked on?
If we take the example of sticking to the COVID pandemic, what are the factors that we know are associated with adverse outcomes, right? So we know that obesity is associated with severity of disease and hospitalizations. We know that existing comorbidities related to heart disease, lung disease. We know that having other malnutrition and related to infections, we know these factors influence the vulnerability, right? So it's all well and good to say, well, people should just get themselves healthy. But if you look at something like physical activity, which is just really vital to maintaining heart health and just all around physical and mental well-being. The pandemic has highlighted that tension, but people have always lived with that tension of risk versus benefit. So you're in a city where the risk, the act of, say, deciding to be physically active outside is a mental calculation of, okay, what air am I breathing? Does that outweigh the risk? Am I going to get injured? Am I safe? Is there actually space for me to do this? So that calculation has always been there. And what we've seen, so just an anecdote from Lagos, what we saw very early on in the lockdown, we saw, despite the fact that they were locked down, full total lockdown restrictions, we saw huge numbers of people going onto motorways and engaging in physical activity. Not necessarily physical distancing. So the public health side of me, one bit of me says, yes, people are embracing physical activity, but then in the context of the pandemic, it's like, oh no, they're not physically distancing. But what you start to see is this unmet need. So you've suddenly created healthy and safe space for health-promoting behavior. So on one hand, it's a perfectly rational response for people to want to take advantage of that. And ordinarily, outside the pandemic, we'd want to encourage that. So then my question is, how do you then say if people want to protect their health and want to reduce their vulnerability by embracing health-promoting behaviours?
I mean, you've written recently that urbanisation in Africa is characterised by continuous flux and adapting to unplanned growth. If flux and kind of unplanned growth is characterised as a city, how can we see progress along the sort of lines that you're talking about?
I think the first thing to note is that flux is not negative. It's just a reality. There is something to be said for thinking about how to identify the positive around the nimble aspects of the urban system. So in talking about the flux, what I actually mean is rather than imposing how how cities are normally conceptualized based on a different model of how cities have developed in other parts of the world, how can we actually confront the reality of how cities are growing in megacities like Lagos and actually look for levers within that reality that we can harness for health? In the context of the pandemic response, spaces that are designated for one thing have been appropriated for the pandemic response. Stadia being used, developed into clinics. We see in Cape Town, the convention center has been developed into a hospital. But in a different mindset, we think, no, that's a convention center. That's what it is. That's a stadium. That's what it is. So the reality, actually, and this is something that the pandemic responses has brought us to confront, there is a lot more space for embracing flux than we generally give credit to. Instead of being reactive, how can we proactively think about how to harness and leverage that possibility for health?
Ash, how does your work suggest that people are sort of negotiating the imperatives from planners or from public health physicians with their kind of immediate environments and the kind of resources they have to hand?
Let me take this in two parts, if I may, and just to pick up on some of the things that Solomon said. I think there are five themes of enormous significance that matter here in terms of urban planning. And of course, there are huge differences between the global north and the global south, but I think there are some common arenas of intervention, let's call them. There are some, looking across the cities of the north and the south and thinking about questions of risk. Tolu is right that we shouldn't be thinking of what the pandemic has exposed as something that's just completely new. There are all sorts of existential risks that face many urban populations, and they've been around for a very long time. And I think what the pandemic has shown up is that, as far as cities are concerned, the areas in which we really need to concentrate, one is meanings of density, where people live and how people live. The whole question of social distancing is really brought right into center stage. What do you do about the question of density? The second theme is the city as a space of healthy living. Again, Tolu is right. All of this has to do with access to green spaces, unused roads, to recreation areas, clean air, and so on. And thirdly, we now know whether you're talking about cities in the developed world or the developing world, that questions of poverty, precarity, working conditions, basic income, welfare guarantees are so crucially important. And then just to close my list very quickly, I think we're also beginning to see another very important dimension here about cities, and that's the terms on which people encounter each other. You've got a lot of vilification at the moment going on of supposedly disease-carrying subjects, the irresponsible youth in inverted commas, and global travelers, for instance. You know, there's a toxicity around this question of which kind of bodies are supposed to be seen as clean and those that are supposed to be seen as disease-carrying. So the terms on which people come together is also very important in the management of the disease. And let's call it the nature of urban public culture.
Ash, can you tell me more about your work in this area?
These different themes work out in very specific ways in particular places. So my work has been on the poor and less well-off migrant populations in the cities of Shanghai and in Delhi. And I've been particularly attending to questions of mental health. I found that, you know, against the grain of thinking in urban studies, that those who are really worse off face huge mental problems in cities because of precarity, because of informality, because of all sorts of urban stresses. When you, as it were, get ethnographic, you go into those neighborhoods in which the poor and vulnerable populations live, then there's an additional dimension, which has to do with how, I call them dwelling practices. How do people actually live out the everyday? Processes and practices of, if you like, domestication, of socialization, of endurance, are ways in which existential risk, existential crisis is kind of made banal, slightly tempered, brought into the present. And that provides people with forms of fortitude. You know, the dimension here that's important is that the microenvironment in which people live with the environment, engage with each other, and they can intervene in the negotiation of stress.
What enabled the people you were talking to find ways to live healthily, if one understands healthily in broad terms?
The difference between healthy living and, as it were, unhealthy living, over and above these domestic dwelling practices, arises, I think, in the nature of those four or five things I said at the beginning. In my work in Delhi, amongst the homeless, where there was a complete absence of state provisioning, of stable work, of regular income, of welfare services, of neighborhood, you know, people just literally camping out along the Yamuna and depending for their lives on scattered provisions from non-governmental organizations. There, all these, let's call them the kind of the vectors of good living, decent housing, decent services, decent infrastructures, stable employment, spaces for recreation, they were absent. So in those circumstances where these generic infrastructures of well-being are not in place in the city, then I think these ground level informalities, which can work in very positive ways, are completely undermined. You know, so my homeless folks in Delhi, and goodness knows what's happened to them under COVID, these individuals leading precarious, fragile, isolated lives, you know, things become immensely worse for them because of the absence of that general infrastructure of well-being in cities. And I think, just to close, that general infrastructure of well-being is as much about the pandemic as it is about pre-pandemic life. The vulnerable have always faced these great difficulties of isolation, ill health, exclusion.
Is it possible to combine those sorts of insights of people's experience in everyday life, living in the spaces that they find, with a sort of position-led, state-led kind of planning approach to cities?
When we talk about unplanned cities, it's important that we recognise that this is not a one-directional, cities are not either planned or unplanned. So we have cities like London, which you'd largely consider planned, but we're starting to see in some of the responses to the pandemic the potential to circumvent planning and the potential for that to introduce toxicity into responses. So when I talk about toxic decisions, quote unquote, or if you bring this closer to home, in the UK, we think about the NHS as being the symbol of health. And when you think about health, you think of the NHS. But that is such an incredibly incomplete picture, because we know that those environments have wield a much wider influence on health of the populations than they take responsibility for. And so if we reframe, I think the first thing in responding to your question, Robert, is reframing the question. So I will pose to you that thinking about building or urban development without health is similar to having quack prescriptions from an unlicensed doctor. So you have somebody giving more prescriptions, but you're actually making health worse. We have to start thinking about those buildings and those urban developments very much as prescriptions. And I think there are three sides to this. One is the supply side, one is the demand side, and what is the bit in between. So if we think about the supply side, really critical to any endeavor to focus urban development and infrastructure and health is understanding the health need in a given community, who would be impacted by the changes in the environment, and what the health implications of those interventions are. And in doing so, really critical to confront the differential vulnerabilities, the differential exposures, and differential access. And for that, you really need to bring together the health and more urban data. And it's a bit disconcerting the lack of dialogue between the two. So we need more dialogue between the building and development sectors and the health agencies. Otherwise, you don't stand a chance of actually uptaking the evidence we know about the links between those environments. The second, on the demand side, I would like to see people demanding health from the urban planner and not just from the NHS. So we have to think about who's prescribing health in my community, and are they licensed urban health prescribers and demanding that? And so tied to that are the metrics that need to consider urban health equity. And then the third point, lastly, is the interaction between that demand and supply. So that for me speaks to the participation. You can't have accountability without participation. And so core to thinking about changing or making more complete accountability for urban health is participation, ensuring that the sectors of society that are most affected by those environments that we're talking about have the power and the agency to affect that change.
Under all the kind of constraints we're living under now, how can we learn and move forward?
So much of our contemporary understanding of cities is that, you know, they're kind of economic machines, and human subjects within these economic machines feed the machine, either by consuming or by producing or by traveling in a frenzied way. And I think what the pandemic has brought back to center stage is the idea of the city as a space of good health and well-being. A good city which places health and well-being as the top priority, what would it then look like? A question that needs to be asked now in the way it was asked in some parts of the world 100 years ago, you know, the Great Garden City movement. These big questions were asked 100 years ago, and we need to ask them again and offer some answers. And I think they fall into two sets of types of intervention that are needed if we put at center stage the city of health and well-being. There are some pressing questions about the character of the built environment in cities, the kinds of buildings that we inhabit, the nature of green spaces, the opportunities that people are offered to get out and about. Wasn't it interesting when there were no cars on the roads and the roads became spaces for people to move around freely? There are huge questions about how we go back to, or go forward rather, to building decent neighborhoods, you know, where those people who have to be out at work during the pandemic, the frontline workers, find themselves living in decent, uncrowded homes. And the pandemic has exposed the unhealthy side of cities. It's not made them more unhealthy, it's exposed the unhealthy side of cities. Second space of intervention, and again, I think the pandemic has shown this, the pandemic uneven effects are thriving on enduring inequalities of income, of social standing, of all sorts. You know, the most vulnerable, the most necessary low-paid workers are the ones who've been hit hardest by the pandemic. One way or another, our national priorities are going to have to shift towards rekindling the essence of a cohesive society. And that has to do with finding ways in which we can bring back the central tenets of universal welfare, you know, access to housing, education, training, income, and all sorts.
Ash, can I ask, is that my sort of final question to you? To what extent is the city central to your view of how, you know, cohesive societies should be reforged?
Most modern populations are concentrated in cities. Life, the economy, populations, everything, the Anthropocene is located in cities. So everything's going to have to happen through cities in any case.
Finally to you. So I'm interested in what you see as shafts of of hope as do we kind of think about good cities for health and well-being.
I would say one word, imagination. Cities have had a magnetic draw for possibility and reimagining things. Somehow we have internalized and become complacent in how we think about the possibility. And so the kind of gleaming shaft of light for me through what we see in the pandemic response is re-sparking that imagination. And we've seen the very imaginative ways that different aspects of society have been canvassed and rallied together to respond to the pandemic. The possibility of rethinking and reimagining urban development and infrastructure, and the potential for the urban form in all its different typologies and urban reform to explicitly and proactively address health inequalities is something that I think we should all be excited about, and we should all rally around.
Do either of you have any final thoughts?
Against all the odds, you know, the kinds of innovations and solidarities that have grown in the middle of the pandemic, there's much to be learnt there. We need to keep an ear to the ground, because the ground on this occasion has shown up some really interesting things.
Let me say a big thank you to Tolu and Ash for joining us. I think that the questions about how to keep our ear to the ground, to learn from inspiring examples of where people are living well in cities, is something we'd like to return to in the future. But for now, let me say a big thank you once again to Tolu and Ash for joining us today. Thank you both very much.
CSAP Science and Policy Podcast is a production of the Center for Science and Policy at the University of Cambridge. This episode of our series on science, policy, and pandemics has been produced in partnership with Cambridge Infectious Diseases and the Cambridge Immunology Network. This episode was hosted by Dr. Rob Doubleday and was produced by me, Kate McNeil. Our guests this week were VK Madhavan, Dr. Tolu Oni, and Professor Ash Amin. You can learn more about CSAP's work by visiting us on Twitter at @CSIPOL or by visiting our website at www.csap.cam.ac.uk. If you have feedback about this episode or questions you'd like us to address in a future week, please email inquiries@csap.cam.ac.uk. Thanks for listening.